Number 42, The Labourers in the Vineyard, Matthew 20, verses 1 to 16. Many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire labourers into his vineyard. Matthew 19, verse 30, and 20, verse 1. And Jesus spake the parable of the labourers. That this parable follows, and in fact continues the discussion which began with the question of the rich young ruler, is thus evident. See the preceding parable of the camel and the needle's eye. That it in some way illustrates the facts of that episode and demonstrates the truth of 19 verse 30 is also to be expected. That the parable contains difficulties is shown by the fact that only one other parable has had a greater number of interpretations. The story briefly concerns a householder who in the morning hired labourers, agreeing upon their wages of a penny a day, which appears to have been good wages for a day's work. At 9 o'clock, at noon, and at 3 o'clock, other batches were engaged, with the assurance that whatever was right they would be paid. At 5 o'clock, when not long remained before the work would be ceased, a further batch of men was engaged, these also being told that they would be paid what was right. At the close of the work, the master ordered the last comers to be called first, and they were given a penny, and so with each batch. Seeing this the first to be employed, contrary to their agreement, expected more than a penny, and when only that sum was paid to them, they murmured, and grumblingly pointed out they had worked longer than the others. The good man of the house replied, "Friend, mate, or my fellow, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good?" What are the essentials of the story? First and foremost is the spirit of the master. He was clearly not an ordinary employer. Did ever any employer act in such a way? Efforts have been made to illustrate the parable from life. The scene is indeed true to life. Men in the marketplace waiting to be hired, an employer engaging men for the day. But no one has matched, from Eastern records or experiences, the unusual conduct of a man engaging labourers near the close of the day and paying them the same as those who have worked all day. It would certainly produce the very result of grumbling that is described. There was something in this unusual conduct that would rivet attention. The bargain of wages with the first called and not with the others is also unusual and should be noted. So also the calling of the last for payment before the others was, from an ordinary point of view, not calculated to prevent trouble, but rather to invite it. Only an exceptional employer would do this, and its place in the story is evidently to provide for the grumbling spirit of bargainers to be revealed. It is principally introduced to reveal the master's mind. Several writers have tried to find in the parable principles of economics that should govern modern life, such as the rights of all for employment and equality of pay based upon not work done, but readiness to work. But all such efforts miss the significance of the matter. The concluding words of Jesus, "Many be called, but few chosen," establish that the parable is a portrayal of God's work. God is calling, God is choosing, and the action and spirit of the good man is designed to show God's spirit and aims. The good man was uncommercial. He was generous to some without being unjust to others. His action was not that of men generally. Neither are divine actions like those of men. The psalmist depicted God's way when he said, "With the merciful thou wilt show thyself merciful. With an upright man thou wilt show thyself upright, and with the pure thou wilt show thyself pure. And with the froward thou wilt show thyself froward. For thou wilt save the afflicted people, but wilt bring down high looks." Chapter 18, verse 25 to 27. But the good man also asserted his absolute rights. He could do as he willed with his own, and the evil eye of a labourer did not prescribe the limits of what he should do. So too God is sovereign, and will give us as he will with his own, paying to bargainers as agreed, generous to those who labour in trust of getting what is right. We trace the parallel with the circumstances which led to the parable being spoken. First, the rich young ruler, and second, and in lesser degree, Peter and the rest of the apostles. The rich ruler displayed a legal spirit. "What must I do to obtain eternal life?" It was the spirit of Israel which was based upon pride and self-complacency, and upon a view of the law in relation to life eternal that put the whole emphasis upon works. In a smaller measure, Peter had shown a similar spirit. "We have left all. What shall we have?" In this, as is said in Nazareth Revisited, there was a mixture of childlike simplicity with just a trace of complacency verging on vainglory. It was perhaps natural that the influence of the Pharisees and of the general way of thinking among their fellow Jews should give an exaggerated place to doing as a condition of favour with God. They could not then see that the only way possible for restoration of man to God's fellowship was through the sacrificial offering of God's Son. Primarily, man can do nothing. He's under sentence of death. His nature is sin-stricken. His will for right is vitiated by sin. He is thrown on God's mercy and can only accept what God has done. Not of works, lest any man should boast. Salvation is of grace. Not that there is no place for works, but good works follow as a consequence of union with Christ, and are not a basis upon which man becomes heir to eternal life. Evil deeds are excluded by that heirship. They are foreign to the state of sonship. The loyalty of sons is thus tested by obedience, and so it becomes also true that a man will be rewarded according to his works. Matthew 16, verse 27, 2 Corinthians 9, verse 6, Revelation 22, verse 12. The parable is designed to correct the mercenary spirit, to show that eternal life is not obtainable by keeping the law, whether of Moses or any other. In the words of C.C. Walker, "Looking back, we realize that the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the Jews were the husbandmen, for the most part wicked husbandmen, called indeed as the Pharisee scribes, and even the good young man, and thinking to enter into eternal life by observing the righteousness of the Lord of Moses, while at the same time many of them posing as murmurers against the good man of the house. and against these last. Galilean fishermen whom the Lord had called to his kingdom and glory, and who are proclaimed by him beforehand to be among the chosen. The whole episode is an eloquent divine enunciation of the truth afterwards more particularly argued out by the apostles in their epistles, that man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the obedience of faith. Some have missed the true meaning of the parable by concentration on the penny and trying to find a meaning for it. In the parable, the payment of the same amount to all was essential to bring out the selfish, calculating character of the one class. The emphasis is wrongly placed when it is centred on the fact that they all had alike. In the answer of the good man, the point is not that he will give to one even as to the other, but that the disposal of his own was at his own discretion. "I will give" is the assertion of a sovereign right, exercised for good, but quite lawfully because he was the owner. "I will give. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good?" All the penny can stand for is the reward, whatever it may be, in this life or another. There may be other applications of minor character. Some who have been long in the field of labour view latecomers with a patronising air, or with some assertion of rights based upon extended service. When disciples hesitated to accept Paul, or opposed him, or treated him as one born out of due time, this last fellow, did the parable ever occur to them as depicting the spirit they displayed? Who then are first, and who are the last, or what is first, and what is last? In the context, the first last are the rich who turn away, who cannot follow Christ. They are the privileged, the legally minded, the men of the present. The first last is the spirit of self-merit, of complacency with human achievement, of life by law. The late first are the humble who renounce the present, who follow Christ, who accept the cross for themselves as followers of him who died on the cross, and who, therefore, do not glory in the flesh, but in the cross of Christ and in the grace of God. The first last are the Jewish legalists, the men of the present world. The last first are the children of faith and of the kingdom and heirs of the age to come. These last will be first, for the future is theirs. For Jesus did not say, "So the last are first," but "shall be first." The man who received payment and grumbled, and had an evil eye toward the good man, was told to take that to thine ears and go thy way. He was dismissed from service, and has no place in the future. Many are called, for wherever the invitation of God is heard, men are called. The Jews were called, but not therefore would they be approved. But failure is not a Jewish peculiarity. Few are chosen is true, whether the word be translated choice or chosen. The first is regarded as the strict meaning, but the papyri show its use in the latter sense. But the chosen will be choice, because God will choose them on account of their excellence judged by his standards. Parables of the Messiah, number 43, A Fig Tree Withered and A Fig Tree Budding, Matthew 21, verses 18 to 22, and 24, verses 32 to 35. The cursing of the fig tree was an enacted parable. a parable in deeds, not words. And since it is related to a short parable of the budding fig tree, both might be considered altogether. In the last week of his life, many things were done and said by Jesus, which were intended to be a final appeal to Israel. The crisis was at hand, and as events hurried to their inevitable close, Jesus unhurriedly completed his testimony. He rode into the city on an ass, deliberately making the claim that he was the king foretold by Zechariah. Zechariah 9, verse 9. He cleansed the temple, thereby asserting the authority that belonged to the Son of God. It was his Father's house. The assertion was recognized, and the rulers demanded, "By what authority doest thou these things?" Chapter 21, verse 23. In the evening he went out of the city for lodging, perhaps sleeping in the open air on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. As he returned to the city in the morning, he hungered. Seeing a fig tree in the way, he came to it only to find leaves. Whereupon he said, "Let no fruit grow on thee henceforth for ever." And presently the fig tree withered away. When they passed the following day, the disciples saw the tree which yesterday seemed to be so full of life, now dead. They asked, "How did the fig tree immediately wither away?" Revised Version. The action of Jesus has been the subject of much criticism. To deny the truth of the incident would be a logical thing for those who take a restricted view of the character and person of Jesus. But to accept the account as true, and then to criticize, is illogical and absurd. If the tree died as a result of the pronouncement of Jesus, then we are in the presence of a divine act, an act not to be criticized, but examined that it might be understood. We dismiss, therefore, at once the charges of petulance and childish impatience which critics have brought against Jesus for this act. The difficulty, however, which some feel with Mark's expression, "the time of figs was not yet," calls for more sympathy and an explanation. If it was not the time of figs, was it not unreasonable to expect them? The answer is that although not the usual time for gathering figs, the expectation was reasonable. A fruit, like flower, precedes the leaves in the fig tree. At the time when Jesus passed, a tree would usually have neither fruit nor leaves. This fig tree, precociously putting out its leaves, gave every promise, therefore, of figs, but it had none. There was profession, but not practice. It was a fit symbol of the deceitful and hypocritical attitude of one with moral pretensions but of immoral ways. It illustrated a religious pretense. It was a picture of delusion and sham. It was a barren tree, for there was neither an old fig of the last season nor a new one of that season. There was no token of past fruitfulness, nor promise of future. The fig tree by the wayside was a symbol of the nation of Israel. Jeremiah had compared his contemporaries to figs, good and bad. Jeremiah 24, verse 1 to 3. The significance, therefore, was not very difficult to understand. But Ezekiel had spoken not only of judgment of Israel in the parable of the eagles and the cedar, but had foretold that the highest branch, the Messiah, would be the means of the nation flourishing again. And, says God, "All the trees shall know that I, the Lord, have brought down the high tree and exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree, and have made the dry tree flourish. I, the Lord, have spoken it and have done it." Ezekiel 17, verse 22 to 24. See also parable of mustard seed. Compare also Hosea 9, verse 10, and Joel 1, verse 7. Who then was this that dried up the green fig tree? Not a man, certainly. For what man could do it? Must it not be, as he claimed in dispute that same day, that he was the Son of God? Not only so, but his words were a sentence, a divine judgment on the nation. For not only was the barren fig tree a symbol of Israel in their unfruitfulness, but the sentence upon it was a prophecy of an impending judgment on the nation. When the disciples asked, "How did the fig tree immediately wither away?" Jesus answered, "Verily I say unto you, if ye have faith and doubt not, ye shall not only do this which is done to the fig tree, but also if ye shall say unto this mountain, Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, it shall be done. And all things whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing, ye shall receive." The answer seems unrelated to the question. It was not really so, but as often with the answers of Jesus, he gave a direct application to the hearers. "Have faith," he said, "and pray, and you will do great things." What was done was an outcome of his faith and prayer. It was also negatively an indication of what was lacking in Israel. They had not faith or sincerity in their worship. Jesus says, in effect, "Be not like those whose end is foreshadowed by that tree." He also said that by faith they could say to this mountain, "Be thou removed." In the central range of hills, Olivet was far from the sea. But what if men of faith do see that mountain cleft by the return of the Messiah? Will not a moved mountain be an irrefutable token that the Messiah has indeed come? Zechariah 14, verse 4. The language of Ezekiel that God would make the dry tree to flourish links up with the parable of the fig tree, which Jesus called upon the disciples to now learn after he had told them of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Matthew 24, verse 30 to 31. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. "When his branch is yet tender, and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh." Verse 32. He at once explained that this revival of the fig tree would be the sign of his coming. "So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors." Verse 33. Luke adds, "all the trees." Luke 21, verse 29, which generalizes the reference and tends to make it only an illustration of an approaching change. In this case, parable becomes a synonym for illustration. But Matthew attributes to the Lord the words, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree." And this suggests that both sayings were uttered, which would be quite possible when we consider that his address would be longer than the few minutes required to read the chapter. The fig tree of Israel has certainly undergone a revival during the last century. The budding branches are the sign that the tree will yet flourish, and the summer of God's kingdom is nigh. In all the trees there are signs that the kingdom is drawing near. Among the Gentiles, the national isolation of the past is breaking down under pressure of circumstances, and all nations are engaged in activities which will logically eventuate in a world government.